One had followed the rules and one had not. But the problem with rules was that they implied a right way and a wrong way to do things, when in fact, most of the time, they were simply ways, none of them quite wrong or quite right, and nothing to tell you for sure what side of the line you stood on. Celeste Ng, Little Fires Everywhere.
Hello, I'm Kennedy Weibel.
And I'm Rebecca Capone.
And this is Reading Pop Classics. Today, we're talking about Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng. This was Celeste Ng's second novel, her follow-up to Everything I Never Told You. That book topped Amazon's Best Books of the Year list in 2014 and was a major debut from Ng. Little Fires Everywhere was published in 2017. Received rave reviews from critics. It got an additional boost from being included in Reese's Book Club, and Reese Witherspoon also produced and starred in a Hulu adaptation alongside Kerry Washington. Little Fires Everywhere spent 3 weeks at number one on the New York Times bestseller list, a little bit late in 2020. It enjoyed a boost from the release of that Hulu series. That's what pushed it up to the top. The novel is set in 1998 in Shaker Heights, Ohio, Ng's own childhood hometown, and it follows the story of two families, the traditional Richardsons and the arty and bohemian Wrights, who come to town and move into the Richardsons' rental property. Rebecca, start us off. Does Little Fires pass the Bechdel test?
It does. Lots of conversations between women, as a matter of fact, and a few of them are actually about males or about relationships. The conversations center more around sort of the themes of the book, for one. And then I think, you know, something that I did like was that the conversations between Lexi and Pearl. Just kind of center around normal teenage girl things without it constantly being about boys. And so I enjoyed that. I thought that was good writing to have like women talk about things besides men and teenage girls talk about things besides boys they have crushes on. You know, they talk about parties, they talk about their friends, they talk about clothing and things like that. So I thought I kind of enjoyed that aspect. And it was a no-brainer on the Bechdel test.
This was interesting because something when we were prepping for this and I was thinking about it, I'm not sure how you would say it, but this passes the Bechdel test so hard that it circles back around into a sort of reverse Bechdel. Two men do not have a conversation with each other in this book unless it is about women. And that would be the brothers, I think, right? Moody and Tripp, unless there's a conversation between them that I'm forgetting, but no two men speak to one another in this book that is not about a woman.
That's really interesting. I hadn't picked up on that, but yeah. And again, there's not a lot of, and this is, so the opposite of this has come up in some other books that we've discussed, but there's just not a lot of conversation between men in this book. The dialogue and conversations are mostly between women.
No, there's not. There's Tripp. Tripp and whatever that goober is whose house he borrows, they talk about like borrowing the house the Tripp can hook up with Pearl. When that same dingus talks to Moody, it is about Tripp, but it is about Tripp hooking up with that girl. So I don't think that.
But it is about Tripp hooking up with a girl. So that does kind of still technically fall into that realm.
Moody and Tripp talk, but they fight about Pearl. Mm-hmm. They talk about Lexi one time when they're talking, but that's their sister.
Which does, yes, but they are still talking about a female.
Yeah, this is a reverse Bechdel.
This is a reverse Bechdel. Oh, that's fun. Yeah. I like that. Nice. I'm glad you picked that up. Yeah, perfect. It Bechdel's so hard, it circles back around.
Yeah, it does. It Bechdel's so hard. Yeah.
I like that.
So this book is about the Richardsons are a real, I don't know, picture-perfect family that lives in Shaker Heights, Ohio. Shaker Heights is a real picture-perfect community outside of Cleveland. And they own a rental property that Eleanor Richardson, the matriarch of the family. Her parents owned it, passed it down to her, and now she rents it out to people that she feels need a little boost. She tries to keep the rent low, and our plot begins essentially with her renting the second floor of the rental unit to the Wrights. And the Wrights are Mia and Pearl. Mia is the mother, Pearl is the daughter, a mother-daughter duo who moved to Shaker Heights, take this apartment, and in the book ostensibly is about the conflict between Mia and Elena Richardson, between these two mothers, because they're so different. And that is the premise. And I don't know, it felt like weak tea to me. What do you think about this book?
Honestly, this is of the books we have done for the podcast, this one was my least favorite. I didn't hate read it, though. You know, it wasn't something that I started and was just like, oh no, and then had to see it through to the end. I think that there are valuable things to talk about, and I think that some of the themes in the book are worth conversation and certainly worth podcasting. I think that those themes are why this book is popular, but I did not think that this was like a great book. This book did not leave me. Some of the other books we have read have, you know, sort of left me with that feeling of, I guess, being like fulfilled a little bit by like what I've read and have a lot, you know, a lot to chew on and a lot to think about and a lot to be like to come into this podcast and be like really excited to talk about it. I think there are books that make you feel a little bit changed when you've finished reading them in some capacity. And this book was not that for me.
Same. I read a review from one critic that said, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, that said, while it is technically great and well put together and, you know, a complete story, I never warmed to it. I never warmed to it. And I never warmed to this. I feel the same.
There weren't any, I didn't like any of these characters. I think the only character I was rooting for was Mei Ling, the baby.
Yeah. This is also, so I didn't hate read this either. It was fine. I don't generally like books like this, and it's not usually the book's fault. It's just not to my taste. And books like this, by which I mean like just sort of small drama within a bedroom community somewhere. But this one was just thin. It was just so thin, in my opinion. This is, I will say, a book that, remember when we were doing Eleanor Oliphant, we said we were both surprised that it was a Reese's Book Club kind of book. It's not what we...
About what any famous person's book club would be. Again, nobody write in to tell us how wonderful Reese Witherspoon
is.
Yeah,
no, she's great.
I love Reese Witherspoon.
Freeway rules. Legally Blonde rules.
And I think she's intelligent. And I think that Oprah is a lovely woman and is intelligent. And they have picked good books for their book club. But then they also pick some books like this. I see why this book appeals to a wide audience of readers. But I think that maybe people that are a little bit more discerning in some of the things that they read would also maybe also feel like this book is thin, you know, similar to the review that you read.
This book fits my prejudice of what Reese's Book Club books are. This is what I think.
This book also fits my prejudice.
Yeah, this is what I think Reese's Book Club books are, is this sort of like, you know, I don't know, a book where at the end of it, like nothing's really happened. Just like, well, that was a slice of life. There's so many different kinds of mothers out there. Anyway, the end. Like, oh, okay.
Exactly. So, you know, if I had read this book without the intention of doing a podcast, I would have finished it and probably forgotten about it. The reason that I continue to think about it for some days after I read it was to think about what, I mean, was in the way that I dissect, and I think about what I wanted to, you know, what I think is worth discussing in the podcast. Like the catalyst for reading the book was the podcast. And then certainly, like I said, you know, any thoughts I kind of had like trailing the days after I finished this book were because I was preparing to discuss it, you know, here, more so than it being something that just like stayed with me and that I kind of thought of like on my own and had some, you know, felt some type of way about after finishing the book. And I can say that about a lot of the other books that we have read or discussed in this podcast. Now, some of those were rereads for me, which is why we read them and discussed them on the podcast. And some of them were new for me and they did still kind of stay with me, you know, for various reasons. But again, this was not one for me. And I do have a major bone that I want to talk about of something that irritated me a little bit with this book. I'm going to pick it. The fire imagery throughout the book, I felt like this woman was just hitting me over the head. Like she thought that maybe I didn't understand the fire analogy throughout this book. Now, I will say that in the first couple pages, I want to say it's one of the first things I highlighted, titular line. Okay, so page 7. The house is burning down. I do kind of like when something starts with like the end of the book right up front. I do enjoy that as like a literary device of like, oh, the house is going to burn down. I appreciate that we learn that like Mei Ling goes back where she belongs, but we don't know what that is. I did kind of appreciate that it's like we don't know where she quote unquote belongs in terms of where the author believes she belongs.
I think that's a real easy thing to mess up. I don't think Ng messed it up in this. I think it works really well at the top of this book because we are still getting plot and we're still getting story and we're still getting development from it. Sometimes I've read authors or I've seen movies or TV shows where they start at the interesting thing and then we have to go back to the less interesting stuff. And it's because they didn't have faith in the other stuff and they just wanted to start with the interesting point to get you in. And yeah. I think that's cheap. I don't think she does that here. I think it works fine in this book, but I think it's difficult to do. And I think she did it pretty well here. I think it works. I agree.
Agreed. So I will, you know, if I'm sandwiching, right. If I'm saying something nice and then picking a bone, I will say that I did think that was a good start to the book. Okay, so Lexi's line on page 7 is, the fireman said there were little fires everywhere. Multiple points of origin, possible use of accelerant, not an accident. So I highlighted that because I do appreciate a titular line. I like it when it's in movies. I like it when it's in books. And I was like, well, that's fun. That's what I thought when I read this. And then as I continued to read the book and just everything is like, there was a little spark.
Oh my God, the spark.
You know, there's a little spark. It becomes a blazing inferno. And it just repeated so many times throughout the book that it just felt really, infantilizing. It felt like when you're in the fourth grade and you're reading a book and then there's a lot of like imagery or something in there because like you're in the fourth grade and you have to write like your one page little paper and you've just learned what imagery is. Like, that's how I felt. Like, it felt very infantilizing and sophomoric. And it was just like, if you use this analogy and this imagery one more time, like, I'm going to put this book down. I didn't because we're doing this podcast on it, but it just, if I had highlighted every time it happened, we'd be here all night discussing the number of times she uses some sort of like fire metaphor throughout the book. And like I said, I get it. I got it on page 7. And then it continued in like every conversation and for each of our characters of like what their little spark is, what their, you know, origin spark is, what their point of origin for the fire is, and blazing infernos, you know, Mia is fiery and Elena has this little spark, you know, that gets put out. And I just,
let's talk about Elena's spark. That we hear about 400 times throughout the book that she used to have a spark and that moving to this very nice suburban neighborhood has somehow put out that spark. I posit this. Elena never had a spark.
There's no spark.
There's no spark. She has to keep, the author has to keep saying it because it doesn't exist. She doesn't show us that at any point.
She doesn't show it.
And that brings me to a bone I'd like to pick with this novel, which is that it is all tell and no show. And sometimes that's fine. Slaughterhouse-Five, for example, was a book where the narrator just tells us the story all the time, in a very, very direct way. Like Kurt Vonnegut is telling us things. But that book has a point of view, and we believe that the author has an opinion and a stance on the stakes and the things that happen within the book. And in this book, it's all tell, no show, but there is no point of view. That is my central problem with the novel, is that it doesn't have a point of view, except that sort of like, huh, different strokes and different people, right? Like it's just so thin. And the whole book is just told to us with absolutely no backup from the characters' actions at all. The characters have almost no interior lives. They're described, they're not even really described to us. They are sketched, really. It's a little bit like she wrote an outline for this book and then went back and filled in the outline. And like, that's the book that we have now. I think that if you're an author is going to tell, like Slaughterhouse-Five does, like this book does, then the narration needs to offer some kind of perspective or opinion on the events of the novel, other than things sure are complicated sometimes, huh? That's just not enough. And that's what left me a little bit cold on this. And so bringing that back to Elena Spark, it's just something that is said to us that like she went to college and she admired the protesters and that was her spark. Like there's no, absolutely no point of her life besides admiring the protesters and I don't know, thinking about like things she saw on television. There is no spark.
Well, she had a hippie high school friend, like a guy who basically asked her to come like live in a van with him and go protest and stuff. This like very like kind of sick, this very like what we think of, you know, as sort of like this traditional like 60s thing. And she ends up and she doesn't go with him, but she has this moment of like considering it. And like, that's her spark, that like, she goes back sometimes on like, oh, like, maybe what if I had done that? And instead I've chosen this very, I don't want to trash what she's chosen. Is there, there's value in stability and planning and order.
Oh yeah.
And so I'm not going to trash and say that's not a thing, you know, like, is there a value for children and growing up with like, routine and comfort and, you know, having your expectations for what your home life is going to be like met? Like, this is a lovely way to raise children. It is not the only way to raise children. It is not possible for everybody that has not grown up with money and stability and that does not, you know, have a lifestyle or a job that provides these things. So it is one lovely way to grow up. So I'm not going to trash like what she's created, but yes, I also don't feel that there was ever a spark.
No.
And then in terms of talking about this like telling and not showing, I felt that Izzy is a particularly underdeveloped character.
Yeah.
To be somebody who burns her entire family's house down.
With her mother in it.
I mean, granted, I think she doesn't think her mom is there. She doesn't think anyone in the family is there.
I know. To keep it safe. Which is just another like little sanitizing detail that I'm like, oh, then
that she doesn't think anyone's there.
All right.
But yeah, like this girl burns her family's house down, which is a huge deal on a thousand different levels. And we see so little of her in the book. Like, we don't know that much about her. We know she wears like, you know, Doc Martens and listens to Tori Amos and that the whole family is kind of mean to her and constantly picks on her for being different, and that she has this, you know, that she's subversive or whatever, but it's like, we don't see a ton of that. I mean, we see her play the prank at school, breaking off like the toothpicks and the locks. And she does that to stand up. She feels that the orchestra teacher the orchestra teacher is pretty blatantly racist to this young Black girl in class. And so she decides to take action against that. And I appreciate that, but we don't get a lot of like, what is it that the family doesn't like about her? What is it? I guess we do get a little bit of like why Elena is so hard on her.
No. I think stick with it. No, we get a little kind of cheap explanation about her being premature and that made her start worrying from an early age. That's not enough.
Right. But Izzy's character is not developed for this absolutely wild display of arson.
Let's talk about the prank and the conductor. by the way, this high school has a conductor. But so the conductor, there's a very shy black girl in the orchestra, and she's messing something up that she's supposed to be playing. And the mean conductor teacher says, "You need me to say it in Ebonics for you to understand it," which is a categorically shitty thing to say. And Izzy jumps up, takes the conductor, the teacher's baton, and snaps and throws it in her face. She snaps it over her knee and throws it in her face. So as you mentioned, her character is not really sketched out, her character isn't really developed. It's like it's forced, right? So like when that incident happens, Izzy won't tell anyone why she did what she did. She won't tell anyone the story of what the teacher said or what happened. And it's just for the narrative. Like it's not, there's no explanation of why Izzy won't say this. Like that she's afraid her mother won't believe her, or she lied in the past one time and now she doesn't trust her own ability to tell, whatever. There's absolutely no credence or no reason given to why Izzy wouldn't say this thing that, by all accounts, everything we've read in this novel, any of the adults having heard this story would instantly understand and be like, "Holy crap, you said what to a student?"
Right, 100%. Like
every adult in this book would have thought that was an inappropriate thing to say to a child.
Wildly inappropriate and racist thing to say to a child.
The author just needs Izzy her to not bring it up so that this like sort of fake confrontation, longstanding confrontation with the family can exist. There's no reason for it. We the reader are not given one.
So that Mia and Izzy can kind of have this moment to bond.
Yes. And all of that feels so unnatural. It feels unnatural while you're reading it. And the prank is just so tonally weird.
Right.
Like Izzy doesn't think to do anything on her own. Mia has to tell her about it. Pearl and Moody have to help her do it. And then the teacher pees herself in front of a bunch of students, which is like this brief little scene out of like Porky's or American Pie or something that's set in the middle of this like serious novel.
It's very TV showish. It's very sitcomish, right? The teacher does something cruel and and flat out racist and inappropriate.
Yeah,
and then is humiliated for it. And then we get the satisfaction of like, yeah, she's humiliated. Now everybody calls her Mrs. Pee Pants or whatever name they come up with her, and she becomes this legend for having peed herself.
Oh, and while we get the satisfaction of her getting this sort of
comeuppance,
very elaborate and arbitrary comeuppance that they didn't plan, it just happens by other coincidence.
And that's part of it too. Is that like that humiliation comes out of it, which is, I mean, it's nice, it's tit for tat or whatever, I guess, but that doesn't come from Izzy. That's just happenstance because this woman is an alcoholic and she's drank all of her bourbon and coffee.
And while she shoehorns in this satisfaction of her humiliation in this sort of like high school movie, TV show way, we don't get the satisfaction of any sort of explanation for like,
yeah,
why Izzy doesn't trust all of these progressive adults, why no other student comes forward about this like kind of major event when a student jumps up, grabs a baton, snaps it, and throws it in the teacher's face, why she wouldn't tell her parents, why she wouldn't tell her siblings, why she wouldn't just explain this clearly not okay situation and her reaction to it. We don't get any satisfaction for that. We just, we skip it so that we get this sort of cheap TV show comeuppance. All of which I think is weird because I watched like 7 interviews with Celeste Ng about this book. And I read several pieces that she wrote about it, essays and interviews that she gave as well. And over and over and over again, she talks about how this is a book about class and race in the 90s. And it's about race in this way only. Does that make sense? Like, it's about race in the, like, the racist lady pees herself. It's not about race in the sense that, like, maybe a student doesn't feel comfortable saying this thing to the adults around them because their racial point of views are fake. Like we like the book doesn't touch what would be a more interesting racial nerve, I think, or a more interesting thing to explore about this area. Like instead, it trades that for the pee pants.
For the pee pants. I do see this book as a vehicle for talking about race. And I do think that the dynamic with Mei Ling is really interesting. Like cross-cultural adoptions, where a child is better off in those situations, culturally, and I think just like the notion of adoption and like what that looks like for somebody who's adopted and like whether or not they're in a better situation for having been adopted. Like those are interesting conversations, but this is a book about two white families.
Yeah, no, 100% agree with you. And while those are interesting things to talk about race, the set piece for them in the novel doesn't match them. Like the set piece in the novel is that a woman like just at the end of her rope who seems to be having some mental issues abandons her child at a fire station, and another family who's been waiting to adopt a child adopts it. And then the other woman, Bebe, finds out through Mia where the child is and decides that now she wants it back. And the family that's been raising the baby for the last a year and a half, I think is what it is. I think it's about a year and a half that she's had it, that the McCulloughs have had Mei Ling, who they've named Mirabelle.
Maybe about, it's nine months, I think, to a year, because they celebrate her first birthday. And very shortly after that.
Yeah. Okay.
They celebrate her first birthday. And then Lexi is talking about the baby in front of Mia, and Mia realizes.
Yes. Okay. You're correct.
And Mia realizes, oh, I know who this child's mother is.
But that conflict is not, or that problem, that problem within the novel, like that is presented to us, doesn't hinge on race.
Well,
like the McCulloughs got a child that came along. They didn't like pick out an Asian kid.
To me, the most interesting part of this novel is the situation between Bebe and the McCulloughs, because Bebe.
Yes. And that would have been a better book.
That would have been a better book. I 100% agree with you. Some background dynamic of like, you know, Mia, you know, how Mia becomes impregnated with Pearl, right? Is for this couple that can't conceive. So they use like the turkey baster method and her egg and her body, right? Her body is the vessel to have this baby. And when it comes down to it, she can't give the baby up.
And again, we get no explanation for why.
And she flees and she lies to them, and we get no explanation for why, like what has changed in hers. There's no showing.
We get no thoughts from her. No thoughts from Mia about it.
There's no shelling. There's no thoughts. And then she becomes enraged and says that, you know, like the McCulloughs have taken this child from Bebe.
Stolen it. They keep saying stolen.
And stolen it. She keeps saying like they've stolen it. They've taken it from her. I'm not blaming Bebe. I understand that Bebe is in a country where she barely speaks the language. She has zero money. And the guy who knocks her up leaves her. And she cannot care for this baby. And she has wild postpartum depression, which is not something that's a conversation in the 90s. Which is not something that's much of a conversation in the 90s. Postpartum depression, I think, is something that we started talking, that's become more of a part of a conversation in more recent years, in the past, like maybe 10 or 15 years, of what can happen, you know, to women after they've given birth, and your hormones and stuff are changing, and you're dealing with trying to take care of this tiny life, this tiny brand new baby that's absolutely helpless. And Bebe's really struggling with that and makes the decision, which she thinks is better for the baby, to leave the baby at the firehouse. The McCulloughs are desperate for a baby. They've tried for years, tons of fertility treatments and miscarriages and a lot of pain and a lot of love and really wanting to place that on a baby. And now Bebe wants the baby back. And that is a fascinating story and an interesting dynamic, because you feel so much for both of these people. And I think the conversation, I think conversations about adoption are really interesting. There's actually, I think for readers that are interested in this line of inquiry, there's a really beautiful article that was in the New Yorker a few months ago about adoption. And it's about people who were adopted and a feeling of displacement of not knowing about it in this, in its, whether it's cross-cultural or not, or, you know, across race or not, feelings of displacement and not knowing where they came from and not knowing their background. And, you know, people in the book saying, like, you know, people have always told me, like, oh, you know, but like, you should count yourself lucky that you were adopted. Like, you should be grateful. And it's like, well, it's not that I'm not, but why am I not allowed to have these other feelings about my adoption? You know, like, lots of people are raised by the people who brought them into the world, and I'm not, and I don't know a lot about myself. And like, I am super grateful that these people took me in and raised me and loved me, but I'm allowed to have these other feelings about it. And it's really interesting. It's just a really interesting look at the perspective of adoption.
Sounds like it would have made a really interesting novel set in the late 90s in Shaker Heights.
Could have made a great novel.
In this book, though, that plot line is placed second.
It's second.
And it's also so unnaturally explored. To your point, the people just become enraged and keep saying the McCulloughs stole this baby, which I think undermines like the intelligence of the characters who are saying it, who, like, I've seen in other scenes are not, like, they clearly understand that the McCulloughs did not go steal this baby. Like, they just keep saying it, though. And nobody, the book doesn't let them, none of the characters right. who are hearing it ever disagree. They never correct them or go, no, the baby was abandoned and like these people adopted it. Like, it's not the situation you've described at all. Like, maybe
the baby was abandoned and it was a,
maybe Bebe does deserve to have her child back. That is totally worth talking about, but it is right. factually, emotionally, and philosophically incorrect to say that they stole this baby.
And Elena feels that Mia is just causing trouble and causing chaos and creating a spark.
So her reaction to this is the one part that I do, that does track for me. Like, she messes with her friend and she's like, oh, you know, this lady is now on, like, I got my eye on. What that makes sense. What doesn't make any sense is that she keeps working in her house, hanging around, and they don't actually talk about it at all for the rest of the book.
And they never discuss it. Yeah. No, Elena's reaction, I agree with you with that. Elena's reaction does track for me, that she feels like,
yeah, these are my people.
You're messing with my friend. Like, exactly what you said. You're hurting my friend, but she feels like she's just doing it to be like mean and to cause chaos.
Because she's so quirky,
and Elena can't see that. And again, I do think that, you know, this brings up the class and the race, like, you know, Celeste Ng wants to talk about, because a big question with McCulloughs is like, how are you going to introduce like culture for Mei Ling? And they're like, well, we're going to take her to a Chinese restaurant, and like, we bought her a panda bear instead of like a regular brown bear.
Okay. So that is hilarious.
And their responses are hilarious. She already really loves rice. It's one of her favorite foods.
If this was a book that went to that place and was arch like that, like American Beauty, the movie, like something that was like meant slightly heightened or maybe not mm-hmm. even heightened, but like drilling into the absurdity of these things and like playing with that, I think it would make this a more interesting read, but it doesn't do that. Like, it presents these things so flat. Like, it's not a book that is meant to, like, it's not satirical. I think it would be better if it was.
It's not satirical. Like, that part is, and that part is clearly meant to be, but it's kind of but it is a little bit displaced in the book.
And look, I understand that in fiction, we take some things with a grain of salt because they need to be presented for narrative so we can think about them in the real world, and they are presented a way so that they fit within the construct of fiction so that we can consider the real world analogs of them more clearly. But it doesn't make sense that anyone's talking about that. Like, the fact that like a mother abandoned her child at a fire station, another family adopted it, and when the conversation arises over what should be done, people are like, the real question here is not the child's welfare, The real question here is, will the child be raised with Chinese culture? The author chose to take what is clearly an important topic for her and shoehorned it into this completely unnatural set piece where it would not exist. Like, at no point in the conversation around Mei Ling / Mirabelle's well-being and who should be raising her would the conversation just would not be this. Like, the issue here would not be that the McCulloughs are not Chinese enough.
Right. It's a weird way to present that conversation. It would be better to present it if, I don't know, you know, if Pearl's birth father that we don't know anything about for most of the book was half Chinese or something and had been taken away from the family, right? And taken away from the culture and spending her life as somebody, you know, who looks Asian with zero idea of her culture and her history, right? Like,
or if Bebe was a woman whose child had been removed from her care under less cut and dry circumstances. If she claimed that it had been taken, yes, from her, taken them to fill a request for an adult, something that was just a little bit more dubious.
Child services had taken them or something, right?
In the way the child was acquired by the McCulloughs. It just wouldn't happen that way. I don't mean to be like just overly literal and pedantic about it. Like, it just simply would not be a topic of conversation in this. There are just laws around abandonment, and that's what the hearing would have been about. That's what the conversation would be about. Like, it would be around the laws of abandonment, the laws of adoption. Not like the real question here is, will she be raised properly Chinese? That just is an insane conversation to lay on top of the situation that the author went out of her way to create.
Right. There's a better way to present that conversation about, you know, birth culture background in an adoption setting, because the conversation would be, to your point, the conversation in the real world in this scenario,
yeah,
is about whether the child can be provided for and whether it's better for the child to be with their biological mother versus versus being adopted. Who can provide for this child the best? Is BB capable of providing for this child? Is it better for a child to be with their biological mother? And then, like, part of what's presented that is presented, yeah, well, that is part of this conversation, that is part of the more realistic conversation, is the class aspect of this, right? That, like, because what we keep looking at is, like, the McCulloughs, she would have a mother and a father, and she'd be rich, so they can give her everything. And with Bebe, this is her biological mother. She will not grow up being the adopted kid that doesn't know anything about her background and that feels like they are missing some fundamental part of themselves from through having been adopted, right? Like, that they've missed that aspect that we build some of ourself and our sense of self around where we come from and who we are, and that is changed and different when somebody is adopted, and that is part of this conversation. So it's like she's created this book to talk about class and race, but again, this is a book about two white families. This is a book about two white mothers disapproving of each other.
And the part about race is laid, in my opinion, just in a very ham-fisted way on a scenario that doesn't support it in a way that does justice to the conversation or makes it seem realistic in any way. Is it Edward Lim is the name of the attorney who represents, yes, Bebe pro bono? The part where he cross-examines Mrs. McCullough about the Chinese books and did she ever buy a Chinese doll is, and again, I know that courtroom scenes in fiction have to be shorthand, but in no way would a lawyer hang his hearing on a series of questions that, if you put the biological mother on the stand and asked her the same questions, you would get the same answers. In the narration, when we go inside Edward Lim's background for a minute, he himself could not buy any of these things. That's why he's got a little...
He would also end up with the five Chinese brothers book.
Also, it just would not, like, the judge would just be like, what are you talking about? Shut up. We're talking about the child's welfare. This has nothing. What are you doing? Mr. Richardson would have objected and mopped the floor with him. And also, it is just preposterous that Mrs. McCullough cannot answer these questions. She sounds suddenly portrayed as imbecilic.
Exactly. She sounds like an absolute idiot. You can see where this line of questioning is going, and you can do a better job of answering these questions.
And maybe I'm harping on it, but like, it's just so outlandish for a hearing about a child's welfare that this would be something that a very competent, we are told, very smart attorney would try, thinking that some judge would be like, no, you know what? You're right. It doesn't. I mean, I know the kid's been to the doctor now and has been fattened up and has been properly fed and all the nutrition and everything has been, like, because it was malnourished before. I know all that's been taken care of, but dang it, he's right. The five Chinese brothers, this is bullshit. Like, it's ludicrous.
You know what's interesting is that, so she goes to great pains. So I'm to circle on what you're saying. She goes to great pains to set this book in the 90s, which I frankly really enjoyed. I really enjoyed all the 90s, yeah, all the 90s references. That was fun and nostalgic. But so she really goes to great stakes to put these 90s references in there to make us understand that we are in a different time. I think part of what she wants to sort of make apparent, the way we talk about race in the 90s is different than we talk about race now. Race is an ever-evolving conversation. It will continue to evolve in 2050. Maybe in 2050, we'll still be doing this podcast and we will read a new book about race and we will be like, oh, remember when we read Little Fires Everywhere? Or remember in the 90s when we used to talk? Right? It's always going to be evolving, which I think is a wonderful thing. But I think this line of conversation, this line of questioning about the culture, that is something that might be a part of this story today in 2024. I do not think that this is not a 1990s race conversation.
No, I don't think so either. I mean, I think the part
saying to a child, do you want me to say that in Ebonics, is part of 1990s racism. I haven't heard the word. I had not heard the word Ebonics in years until I saw it in this book. That is 1990s race. That is a 1990s race thing, right?
Yeah.
This conversation about Mei Ling is a 2024 conversation. I can see that being part of a trial today. I do not see it being part of a trial then.
No, I mean, it's a hearing
I don't know how much it would be part of a hearing today necessarily, but there would be, but in terms of like the media hoopla around this would be so.
The media conversation would be around it. I think an actual trial.
And I do think that, but I do also think that race and culture would be taken into account in today's society.
I think definitely in the media conversation around it, it certainly would be. I think as far as the law goes, it's just sort of like the state has laws around child abandonment and what happens, and these are them. And, you know, were they violated or were they upheld, I think would be the end of it. And I do realize that a courtroom scene does in a work of fiction is sometimes doing multiple jobs to like reflect like a larger conversations and larger pieces of the plot, and we just need to use it to condense. I have a theory. So her first book that was very popular, and this one was also popular, but her first book, Everything I Never Told You, she wrote it over 6 years, and it was like four complete different drafts that she put into that. This book, I think she wrote in like a year and a half after the success of that first one. I think that her first book took off like gangbusters, and there was an agent and an editor who was like, you need to, it doesn't, just write it, write the outline, fill it out, give us the book and go, 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 go. Reese is waiting. That's what I think this book
is. You know what? That's a good point. Especially like the Shaker Heights setting too, because that's something that she knows. The 1990s is something that she knows because she grew up in Shaker Heights in the 90s. So that
she is
makes,
the same age as Lexi and Serena Wong.
So that makes, yes. And so that makes a,
She's my age. She's we are the same age, me and her.
So that makes it easier to write something.
Because this feels like the outline of a really great book that got rushed. That's what it feels like to me. I don't have any proof of that, but it feels very much
that tracks.
You know how like if someone, you know how something that was like that had grander aspirations, when it misses, you notice it more?
Yes.
Because it was just going for something great, something bigger. I hate to, that's what this feels a little bit like. Like, I feel like I wouldn't notice maybe some of the things that I think are lacking in this book as much if it was just in a cheaper novel. But this one doesn't feel cheap. This one feels like somebody was really had some like great bones here and just, you know, rushed the final construction because it's hard to be an author and it's hard to make money and like strike while the iron's hot. And Reese Witherspoon has a book deal waiting for you and a television deal if you can just get this thing out the door. And I don't falter for it. I also don't know if that's entirely true, but that's what this
and that tracks. Book feels like. I agree. I can see that. I can't argue that point with you. One more thing I do want to talk about. So another theme in this book is motherhood or raising children and the circumstances under which we're raising children. So Mia and Pearl live this like vagabond lifestyle. Mia, you know, sells her artwork here and there. She gets these odd jobs to kind of pay enough money to feed them. And she does her art, and, you know, so she can have time for her art.
Which upset me in the beginning of the book.
That she lets her daughter live this lifestyle?
I started the book not liking Mia very much and thinking Elena Richardson was a better parent. And something that I do think was very effective was by the end of the book, in the narration, the narration successfully changed my mind about each of the characters. Like Mia's arc brought her into a much more favorable light by the end of the book for me, and Elena's arc brought her into a less favorable light by the end of the book for me.
I didn't like Elena from the beginning, to be honest. But I agree with you about Mia. In the beginning was a little bit like, this is a terrible.
It's a crappy childhood you're giving your kid, and it's selfish.
And you know what? I actually kind of still thought that at the end of the book, her daughter's not socialized. She doesn't have a lot of friends. She finally makes friends and they have to leave again. Like it's not about money. It's the moving around all of the time. Not having possessions. It's what we talked about a little bit in the beginning. It's not having routine. It's not having friends. It's not staying places for more than like, you know, they're not even staying places like a year. This girl doesn't have any friends. Her first relationship is with Tripp because she's just never been around long enough to ever like, maybe I have a crush on a boy. And then we move like 3 or 4 months later, her education would be like she's very smart. It's something that we are told throughout the book. Again, we don't really see that, but we're told that she's very smart. So we can assume that her education hasn't suffered, but you're going to tell me that you're going to move a child around every few months and that she's getting a decent education. She's not.
And also it's only because it's her mother's whims. They're not being chased.
They're not being chased. The husband and wife, they think she lost the baby.
To the best of our knowledge, yeah.
They have no idea. They're not looking for her, right? Like, that to the best of their knowledge, she's lost the baby. She doesn't leave a forwarding address. Like, they're not looking for her. She doesn't have a reason to keep doing this.
I don't think that's okay. But I guess by the end of the book, because she did mean to stay in Shaker Heights.
She did. But her daughter's like 16 when she wants to, well, 15.
Yeah.
She's 15 time.
At the end of the novel, when Pearl demands an answer from her mother as to why, what is this, tell me, and Mia actually sits down and tells her, and we heard earlier that every time Pearl asked any questions about her past or what they did, she just got these like
vague answers.
You know, she got she got stonewalled, like just nothing. So when Mia sits down with her and actually tells her reasons and gives her real answers, for me, that was a character change. Like I saw Mia go from totally selfish and totally self-involved and completely mostly like unconcerned about how this was impacting her kid to someone who changed her mind and made a change and became a person who could answer a question, who could be honest and tell her something real, is sort of just where she like won a little bit for me in terms of character development.
Yeah.
They still have to move. It's still a bummer.
Yeah, but that's fair.
And she is,
I don't think she's a terrible mother. That is not, there's so much that goes into being a parent that I don't see her as like, oh, you're a terrible mother, but the constant moving and the instability, I think is a poor decision. It's a poor parental decision.
And for Elena, like you said, like, I don't want to crap on the lifestyle that she set up for her kids, because like, it's really, really normal to want safe, stable, good schools. Like, these are all regular things to want for your child. And her kids are a little bit older, so she's got, you know, they're out of the house a little bit more. She's giving her kids a little bit of a leash to do their own thing. He goes from that to like stealing medical information from a woman that she tries to blackmail and bully about having gotten her the position and introduced her to her husband, and then breaks into her computer and steals that information and then uses it incorrectly because she gets it wrong without like, and then uses it nefariously. She went from like, you know, I know we're kind of like supposed to like slightly make fun of people who are like good suburban citizens, but that is, she went from like a somewhat noble person to, I was like, oh, you scumbag. That is a scumbaggy thing to do.
It's a super scumbaggy thing to do. And that arc is what I want to talk about. So we have this comparison throughout the book on who's the better parent, because we see it with Bebe and the McCulloughs. The McCulloughs are married. They have they have a lot of money. They offer stability, and Bebe cannot offer those things. Bebe can offer the fact that she really loves her child, and that it is her biological child, and that's great. But we see a similar comparison, right, with Mia and how she's raising Pearl and the Richardsons. And what is interesting to me is the way Lexi's abortion is used as though that's what's made one of them the bad parent, because Elena comes to Mia, you know, of like, oh, you know, your daughter is as amoral as you, which is a very anti-feminist perspective. That is a direct quote. Your daughter is just as amoral as you are. However, we know that Lexi is the one that had the abortion. So I feel that the book casts a little bit of like, you know, I feel like the book casts a little bit of judgment, and she uses an abortion to do it. And I didn't love that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Is that more of a 90s attitude than a 2024 attitude? It is a little bit, I guess, perhaps. But I felt like, that's where we get that comparison of like one of her children burns the house down.
Yeah.
Her other child has an abortion.
Yeah. I don't disagree with you. I hadn't put it on the novel. I had left that purely in Elena's lap, that it was like,
because Elena does cast judgment.
Her false sense of progressiveness, her false sense of like, you know, being a modern person with modern sensibilities.
Until she thinks that her child, her son, is responsible for this pregnancy, but she casts the blame and she casts that this is amoral. She casts the judgment on Pearl, on the female, not on her son.
Well, to be fair, she goes in to lay into Moody about it until Moody seems rightfully baffled.
Yes.
And then she's like, you didn't know.
It's true. She does. So she does assume, I guess, that's a good point, that she does assume.
But
that
no,
Trip
I guess you're
know.
Right, though, because she doesn't, you know what? She doesn't ever go to Trip about
but,
it.
Right. Exactly. But she makes the decision to not go and talk to Trip about it. That's in it too. She decides to not go talk to him. She goes and confronts Mia.
She does. She lets him completely off the hook for it.
She goes and confronts Mia, and her kind of opening line is like, I know you, you're a liar. I know your secret. And I know that your daughter's just as shitty as you are, basically. And that's why she thinks that this woman's daughter is shitty. But we, like I said, as the readers, I think that the book, and I don't, and this is maybe not her intention. Again, we've discussed this book has some potential that it doesn't quite live up to. And maybe it is the rush. But I feel that this book uses the abortion to say, Ellen is not as good of a parent. Maybe this isn't.
No, I think you're right. I think you're correct.
Two of these kids and Moody, which, sorry, if I'm going to trash one more of the kids, Izzy confronts him about why would you have told mom about Trip and Pearl? And he says, she was sneaking around with Trip of all people. And he's hurt, right? He's been in love with this girl and she's sleeping with his brother. So I'm giving it to him. But he says
he was also being held accountable by an adult in his life for having gotten a woman
pregnant and then realizing that it's his brother.
Yeah.
Has done this with a girl that he loves. But he says, look, she decided to sleep around. She deserves whatever she gets.
No, he's crap. I mean,
he's casting judgment too.
No, you're right. The book 100%, like, that's the, like, get, right? Like, oh, she thinks Mia is the one who's crazy, but it's actually her and her lifestyle that led to this moral failure. That is how the book casts it. Like, that is how we as the reader are supposed to, like, take...
Two of her children have done the
comeuppance kind of, like, thing. And she doesn't know that her daughter has had the abortion, but she is going to know, because I believe Lexi when she said, I might tell my mom one day.
She's going to find out eventually.
No, you're right. The book does kind of use it.
And like I said, that maybe isn't the intention.
No, I think that's the intention. That's the, like, big get that we as the reader are like, she's acting this way, but we know who the real parent of the abortion girl is. Like, that's what the book is telling us, right? Yeah.
We know who's the mother of the arsonist and the abortionist.
Can I tell you a part that also is when they get to the rental house after the house burns down and Mia and Pearl are gone and they all stop to look through these pictures and see themselves in it and just like, oh man, that crazy magical old Mia, she did it again. She like showed us the true side of ourselves. Your house burned down and one of your children is missing. You drove this woman away. What is this weird little moment doing at the end of this novel where they're all of them, including her, like stop and like take time to consider these photos?
Right. I want to end the book by saying, not end the book. I want to not only trash the book. I think something that I enjoyed the trip down memory lane. I did enjoy the 90s setting. I enjoyed the use of that. I enjoyed the use of it being a different time and there not being social media and there not being like cell phones and stuff, because that does drive a story very differently. It drives stories very differently. And I appreciate it. I wrote down some of the references. There was a Mighty Mighty Boston's reference.
Yep.
Alanis Morissette. The Delia's catalog, which, like, I mean, absolutely amazing. I loved the Delia's catalog. They mentioned hacky sacks when all the toothpicks are in the locks and they can't have class, all the kids are going outside and you know, sacking. Jewel CDs, pagers, and the movie Deep Impact. Oh, and when everybody's feeling like real angsty, Moody's like in his room being sad and like listening to jazz before his mom comes in. And Izzy's feeling sad because she knows that Mia's leaving or something. And her mom walks by her room and she's listening to Tori Amos.
Yes.
And I really appreciated that. So the 90s nostalgia. The 90s nostalgia was kicking. I did appreciate. I appreciated the setting a lot. I appreciated the description of Shaker Heights. You know, this woman clearly grew up there, so I felt like the setting was great. I think that there are things in this book that are well done and well written, like mentioning, you know, how she starts the book with the fire, and then we work backwards from there. Those were things that I like. So, you know, I didn't think this was a terrible book. I just didn't, it was just not my favorite of the ones we read. It fell a little flat for me.
I didn't think it was terrible either. There are like three novels in this novel that I would have liked to have read, like the Mia in New York, this decision to have the Ryan's child, and then her changing her mind, her like relationship with those photographers is kind of like a whole story that could have been its own book. The story of the McCulloughs and Bebe, the cross-cultural adoption and raising of children and where you place them, I think would have been a really fascinating book. And I don't know, probably a light-hearted dramedy about the crazy artist lady who rents the house and, you know, the kind of picture-perfect Shaker Heights family would have probably made its own good book as well. I just didn't feel like they should all be in the same novel. All of them a little thin and all of them competing for space in this single book. I don't know. Would you recommend it?
It would depend on who I was talking to. There is an audience for this book. It was not me or you.
I would say this book is fine. I would say that if you like books like this, you would do better to read Big Little Lies, which I think is a similar tone, or intended tone anyway, female driven, Reese Witherspoon involved.
Reese
actually,
Witherspoon is also involved in it.
She's in the adaptation of that also. I think Big Little Lies is.
And I enjoy Leanne Moriarty as a writer.
Yeah, I would say.
I will state, I have not read Big Little Lies. I only saw the HBO series. But I have read other things by Leanne Moriarty. So I recognize like her handiwork and her storytelling.
I've only read Big Little Lies, and it was a book that I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it. I didn't know much going into it. I just knew that it was popular, kind of like this one. I think I read it after this one. I would recommend that over this. There's nothing wrong with this. It's fine. I would maybe go back and I've not read it, but I would maybe go back and read Celeste Ng's first book. If you were going to read a Celeste Ng, I'd maybe go there.
Maybe start with that and see what you think.
Do you want to do quotes? Yeah. Do you have any quotes?
I have, well, mostly the thing that I enjoyed the most. Oh, you know, I did have one more thing to say. I did have one more nice thing to say.
Bring it.
And I enjoyed the way she writes about art, about Mia as an artist and her process and her art. I did appreciate that she clearly is someone who has an eye for art and appreciates art. I felt like that came through on the page, and I felt like if there's one thing that she does kind of show in this book, that maybe it is Mia as an artist. So the artistic language, the discussion of like the art, you know, Mia's like artistic process and stuff, that was, I enjoyed that. That was something I thought was well done in this book.
I liked Mia as a little girl taking pictures in the pencil. Is it Western PA where she's from? Pittsburgh, right? Outside of Pittsburgh, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed that part. I enjoyed her relationship with her brother. Again, we don't get much of Mia's thoughts about any of that. It's just given to us. But I did like where that story could have been going. And I also, I enjoyed the like development of an artist, like from her being like young all the way into New York, like what she learned and like her process. I think she described that really well. And I thought that was an interesting part of the book. I also liked the kids. You mentioned like all the like nostalgia things. I liked the kids going home every day after school to watch Jerry Springer. Like I remember that.
Yeah.
That was part of the routine. There was like a 1 year period where that was the wildest, craziest thing on television. We've surpassed it 20 times by now, but those at the time were heady days. Another nostalgia point was that she does bring up the Bill and Monica scandal.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the references to the Clinton administration throughout the book, and how like initially when the Mayling trial starts, there's like not a lot going on in the news. And then Bill and Monica scandal comes up. So I appreciated that. I do have two
I also
quotes.
liked Bebe. I should point this out. Bebe does not get a lot of screen time, a lot of page time, since we're talking about a book. And like, in my opinion, like all the characters in this book, she is underdeveloped. She is sketched at best. But I did like the parts with her. Like
Yeah, I appreciate her as a character. She's an empathetic
she's an
character.
empathetic character, but I also she wasn't just a I don't know, like a little figurine for us to hang this sort of plot around. Like she had some like meat on her, like as far as like a character goes, like a little more than she could have had given how like thin everyone else is drawn.
I'll go with that too. She does have a little more meat on her.
I like that the way that resolves is that Bebe kidnaps her own child back and flees to China. Conceptually, I really like that. I think that is exciting storytelling, and I think it's an ex I think it is also not unrealistic. I think it is an exciting decision to make as the author to give us that.
I appreciated that because while I had a lot of empathy for the McCulloughs, like I really did. I really understood, and I did appreciate that it was a difficult situation where you were sort of rooting for both of these characters, or for both of these families, I guess, BB and the McCulloughs. But yeah, I really wanted BB to have her kid back. I honestly really did for a lot of reasons.
Realistically, the hearing would have ended with the McCulloughs getting that kid.
Yeah,
I think the
definitely.
book needs to end with Bebe getting that kid, and it does. I think that's like a good part. Like you are kind of rooting for both of them because like no one's really in the wrong. Like the McCulloughs did not actually steal a child.
Disappear into China, try to find me
Yeah,
now.
I have two quotes.
I have two quotes as well. I'll go first. My first one is just a funny one. When they're at the Lexi takes Pearl to a party, and then she leaves to go have sex with her boyfriend for the first time, and Pearl decides she wants to go home, and the party's getting wilder. And the quote that I like is Stacy Perry's the girl who throws the party. At just past midnight, Stacy Perry herself, trying to pour a glass of water, vomited into the Brita pitcher, and Pearl decided it was time to head home.
Okay, now
I just enjoyed that. I thought it was funny. It just seemed like something that could legitimately happen at a high school party where everybody has a little too much to drink and gets sloppy, and it made me laugh, and this wasn't a funny
I
book.
agree with you.
So I
I agree
enjoyed
with you, but I have to amend what I said before. I have one quote now. Yeah,
it. Oh, was that also yours? I should have known you would probably also pick that.
that was my first one.
All right. Go on with your quote.
I have the docent giving the class a tour was elderly and thin and looked as if all the juice had been sucked out of him through a straw via his pursed mouth. I liked everything about that sentence.
I liked that sentence too.
I liked that there's a docent in it. The pursed mouth, tying that into like the straw that sucked out, all that I thought was great.
It's well written. It was a good line. My last quote is I think just maybe something that more that kind of touches that touches on some of the themes in the book. And this is so Mia, so we didn't talk about these characters very much. You brushed through them earlier, but so in Mia's time in New York, when she's in school, she makes friends with Pauline, who is like a famous photographer at the time and an instructor at her school, and her girlfriend or partner or wife, I don't remember if it specified their legality of their relationship, but Mao. And she spends a lot of time with them. They take her in. They really recognize her sort of ambition and talent as an artist. And she says, in Pauline and Mal's house, nothing was simple. In her parents' house, things had been good or bad, right or wrong, useful or wasteful. There had been nothing in between. Here, she found everything had nuance. Everything had an unrevealed side or unexplored depths. Everything was worth looking at more closely. And I like that because I think that's something that we see. I think that's something that we see in like the in the conflicts in this book. And again, they are told to us more than they are shown. But that major theme, I think, is there. And I think maybe also just kind of seeing both sides of it. Like, you know, you were saying, I really feel for the McCulloughs. There was a part of me that like, I want them to have this baby. I understand how much they want a child and what a horrible and painful thing this would be for them. And I also see that for baby.
All right. So that was Little Fires Everywhere, 2.5 out of 5 from Reading Pop Classics, it sounds like. But
agreed.
Next week, because we have done some serious books, like the one we just did, some serious books that are a little more bummers, like Parable of the Sower, some that ended on a hopeful note, but were still pretty dark, like Eleanor Oliphant is completely fine. And I need to do one that is just not... that is just not laced with so much gravitas. So next time we are doing Douglas Adams, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. This will be maybe my 25th read of this particular book.
This will be a first read for me, and I'm pretty excited.
Hell yeah.
And I'm excited to talk about something lighthearted,
yeah.
Because we've not done that in a minute. I guess since Confederacy of Dunces, our first podcast.
Yeah, that one was
so
partially experimental. That was the first episode.
Yes.
That doesn't count.
Yep. So we're going to talk about something actually funny. Not like when I said that I thought Eleanor Oliphant would be lighthearted based on the back of the book and the cover, and then was wrong. Because it was not lighthearted, but it was funny and an enjoyable read. But this is something that is actually funny, actually lighthearted, and we're looking forward to discussing it.
Yeah, Eleanor was sort of bleakly and blackly funny. Not.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
We had a great name for it. Humorous nihilism,
yeah.
Something along those lines.
So thank you all for listening. I do feel like I've not done this before, but if you are listening to this podcast regularly and you are enjoying it, I think for the benefit of the podcast itself, it would be helpful if you subscribed on whatever platform you're listening to, or if there's a like button accessible to you, you should push that. You can probably tell from the tone of my voice that I'm not entirely clear what functions these things serve or if they exist. Whatever platform you listen to this on probably has some sort of method of approval for this podcast. So it'd be really helpful for us if you utilized it, whatever it may be. And as always, you can write us with thoughts, books, suggestions at readingpopclassics@gmail.com. Thanks
for listening.